From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the stigma surrounding mental health awareness in the Latinx community. We'll learn about a new book that covers the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement.
I wanted to contextualize for people that this is really like a part of a long history in America of peaceful protests coming together to make meaningful change.
Bubbler Talk explores why there aren't any historically designated landmarks for Milwaukee's Latinx community.
The fact that Latinos don't have any recognized place in the National Register speaks to that larger forgetting of a century-long history of our people in the state.
Plus, Milwaukee and Memphis collide in our Pandemic Performers series. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with this. September is Suicide Awareness Month. We're also in the middle of Hispanic Heritage Month. And in honor of both, we're going to revisit a conversation about mental health awareness in the Latinx community. Amy Osorio Ayala and Amira Rupnik are both of Latinx heritage. Osorio Ayala was born in Puerto Rico and Rupnik is of Brazilian descent. And they both have something else in common: personal experiences with mental health issues. WUWM's Angelina Moshe Salazar spoke with them in October of 2019 about their experiences and creating mental health awareness in the Latinx community. And we would like to note that there are discussions of eating disorders and suicide in this conversation.
One thing that I want to talk about that I think doesn't often get a lot of attention is mental health awareness in the Latino community.
Absolutely. I can definitely agree that it is something that is not spoken about. And I think it's because a lot of people, for one, are not educated on it and how to be able to help those that are suffering. But also it's seen as a bad thing. It's like a bad word. Like, mm-hmm. No, there's no reason why you should be depressed. There's no reason why you should feel this way. Especially because us women in the Latino community, we do so much. We're mothers, we're sisters, we work, we're students. And it's very difficult to have a day off, quote unquote, to be able to feel how we feel.
Absolutely.
Like I was saying earlier, it's something like we're seen as locas. We're seen as it's crazy for you to, you can't say that. You can't feel that way. So
and loca means crazy for our non-Spanish speaking audience that that's what you call somebody who is, experiencing symptoms of a mental illness. It's just like a crazy person.
Or no estés amargada. Like don't be so bitter. And it's like, not only just for women. I know there are men out there who also feel this way. Just in the Latino community in general, it's just something that, because Latinos, we're just very vibrant. So it's not right, quote unquote, for you to not be vibrant. It's kind of so different. It's like, what are you doing? Don't be that way. So it's a stigma in the Latino community. Absolutely.
I do want to dive deep into this term, mental health. Like, what does that mean? Okay, if we're gonna bring more awareness to this, if we're gonna talk about this, like, is that just like you're depressed? Does that mean, you're suicidal? Does that even include things like anxiety that is under the umbrella of mental health awareness? So, Amy, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. So, mental health really is the umbrella of several illnesses. It does include depression, suicidal thoughts, or just suicide in general. Anxiety, I know it has OCD, BDD, which we will shortly speak about. And there's many more illnesses that go undiagnosed and untreated. And because they do go undiagnosed, they are pushed aside, kind of like, oh no, it's not as important as the other ones. But mental health awareness is really just a movement to be able to bring it up to the surface and give the people that are struggling the space to speak about it and seek help. I have a few statistics if I
can.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So 1 in 5 adults live with mental illness. It's highest among women. 22% of women struggle with it. And there's about 15% of men who struggle with it. And I also have that depression has risen 18% in the last decade. And half of those people are untreated. I have a huge problem with that. When I was about 18, I was off my mom's healthcare, and at that time I was still struggling with depression, where I didn't leave the house. I did not do anything. I actually dropped out of college at that time, didn't have a job. So I literally spent my life for the 4 or 5 months at home, and not being able to see my doctor and not being able to tell someone, like, I'm struggling, I don't know what to do, was really tough. And it ties back into being the oldest and having to perform, having to not be that person at home because my siblings would see that. And it's like, I don't want to have that effect on them. I don't want them to think, you know, this is the life of a depressive person. So it really does put a strain on my heart.
Mm. Thank you so much for sharing that, Amy. And for just bringing some more awareness. Amita, I know that you want to talk about something that isn't so well known, like depression or anxiety or suicide, something that kind of flies under the mental health awareness radar.
Yes. So that's body dysmorphic disorder, BDD for short, or body dysmorphia. So body dysmorphia is a severe mental disorder where a lot of the features are similar to OCD and eating disorders. You're being preoccupied basically with a perceived or imagined physical defect that you have. It's typically things that other people don't notice or can't see. That includes always seeking reassurance from people, or
like saying, like, hey, does my skin look good, or does this outfit look good?
It's even like negative, like, does my skin look this bad? Or do I look too big in this? Do I look too small in this? It's rarely positive things, you know, because.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's that constantly checking any reflection you see yourself in. Also grooming. So, you know, fixing, adjusting your clothes or fixing your makeup or adding makeup or something like that. The average of how many hours a day anyone with body dysmorphia focuses on their appearance is about 8 to 10 hours a day.
Wow.
No one talks about it. So that leaves people in the dark about it, but it also leaves the people that are actually suffering from it in the dark about it. I do have some statistics.
Absolutely. Let's share them.
So there are 200,000 cases a year of people with body dysmorphia, and that's only reported. So I did mention body dysmorphia is very underdiagnosed. So this number, we don't even know if it could be way higher, a little bit higher. 80% experience lifetime suicide ideation. Yeah.
Well, I know that you have a very personal tie to this disorder.
So I've suffered from body dysmorphia since I was about 13 years old, which is actually common for people. It's younger. It's getting younger and younger. I was absolutely clueless about what I was even experiencing, and that kept me from admitting it to anyone, because if you don't even understand what you're going through, how are you going to explain it to someone else? But before my freshman year of college, I reached a point where I felt like I was actually in danger. When you're experiencing suicidal ideation, you're not thinking like, wow, this is normal for me every day. You know, and then when you step back and you're like, that's not normal. And at that point is when I felt like the suicidal thoughts were just getting more intrusive, to the point where I didn't feel safe. And that really pushed me to address that I was struggling. So I opened up to my mom about it. So she's very encouraging, and she directed me to the next step. So I went to my pediatrician at the time, and he referred me to a specific clinic that specializes in eating disorder treatment. So what they did was they conducted a screening to determine what kind of help I needed, because it is very different. Like, everyone suffers differently. So that process really showed me, I guess, the severity of what I was actually going through. And then that's when I discovered that the problem that I was struggling with was body dysmorphia. You hope there's other people that you can relate to.
You didn't want to be alone.
No, of course not. Because you already feel alone, like completely alone, even though you may not be alone. And it affects me personally still till this day, of course, including my personal self-esteem, and that I really tend to base my worth off of how I look. So I could do anything. Like, I could do well in school. I could help someone out. And, you know, that doesn't matter. You just throw that out. You're like, oh, okay, but this.
So all of your achievements seem minor.
Oh, absolutely.
Or pale in comparison.
Yeah.
Because I need to look a certain way.
Yep. And if I don't, then I failed. It's not looking at the things you're actually doing, you know? Examples. So for me personally, it's hard to get out of bed. There are some days where I can't physically even get out of bed because you're just thinking. You're like, the rest of my day, I'm going to be thinking about this. And you don't want to do that. But then you end up sitting in bed, not doing anything, not being productive in any way. Simple tasks become difficult and sometimes feel like the end of the world, like going to the bathroom, brushing your teeth, taking a shower. It's just dreadful. It's like it's almost like you're so exhausted that you just want to lay there and just be miserable, you know?
And can you help me understand a little bit, why is it so difficult? Why are those simple tasks so difficult? Is it because you're going to see yourself in the mirror, or is it because you're just like, I don't even want to go outside, or walk me a little bit through those feelings?
Well, personally, from my experience, I can honestly say that I worry about how I look almost all day. It'll determine my day. So if I'm not feeling good about how I'm looking, my entire day is shifted, you know, because it's based on that one, do you look good or not? Or is this thing that you're imagining there or not? But it's like that battle, like in your head, like, do I want to ignore these thoughts and just go on with my day? But then, you know, sometimes you don't win. Sometimes you do let
cutting it. Into that too, for me personally at 17, 18, it was more of like a self-punishment.
Yeah.
Like you said, when you don't perform from what you believe you're supposed to perform and you don't perform, you fail. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you don't deserve to get out of bed today. You don't.
Yeah.
For me, that's how it was. Like I was punishing myself. Like you don't deserve to take a shower today, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so disheartening to feel that way, like to look back and like, oh my gosh, I was that. Mm-hmm. Like that's how bad mental illness got to me, that I thought that I didn't deserve little basic tasks. So that was right. That's how I felt.
That is a big part in it. It's like, you do you deserve to even go on about your day? So my body dysmorphia really jeopardized my school and work life. I would skip lectures. I would be so exhausted with life that I would come home and sleep, wouldn't do homework or anything, and it affected my grades really bad. There were times where I'd feel so unmotivated that I would call in sick to work because I just couldn't, you know, I just couldn't go interact with people. Simple, like a simple little task. And my social life currently, I mean, it still gets affected because, I mean, I've had many fallouts with friends because they don't understand it, you know, they don't understand the crippling disorder, like how crippling it is. And, you know, sometimes, like I said, you can't get out of bed. You make all these plans, but you're like, when the plans come, you're like, I can't. Yeah. I can't do it. Sometimes even texting a friend back is effort, and it's exhausting and draining. And, you know, they take that personally. And I mean, as a person that doesn't understand it, how else would you take it, you know? So, it did affect a lot in that aspect for me. That's why, though, it's so important for me to spread awareness to it, so that, let's say someone is doing that to you, you can at least be like, okay, maybe they're really going through something. What can I do to help? Instead of, you know, taking it personally and then cutting off ties with people that, you know, meant a lot to you. There are a lot of people that it affects, and also those people are in the dark about it, too.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Amira.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Adios. Ciao. To everyone.
Ciao, everyone.
Amy Osorio Ayala and Amira Rupnik are members of Milwaukee's Latinx community working to spread awareness about mental health. They spoke to WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar in October of 2019. We have more on Suicide Awareness Month, including resources for those struggling with suicidal thoughts and mental illness, at WUWM.com. There you can also find more coverage of Hispanic Heritage Month at WUWM.com/Hispanic Heritage. Coming up in about 20 minutes, Milwaukee and Memphis singer-songwriter Zach Pietrini and McKenna Bray join us to talk about their new EP, Modern Love. But first, author Veronica Chambers joins us to talk about her new book for young readers, Call and Response, The Story of Black Lives Matter. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In 2020, we all watch history being made in streets all across America and the globe as the Black Lives Matter movement brought thousands of people of all ages, races, genders, and backgrounds together to stand up for social reform. What first started as a hashtag in 2013 grew into a movement that's a testament to the power of protests in America. And author Veronica Chambers wanted to break it all down to teach young readers about it. Call and Response, The Story of Black Lives Matter, looks at how a moment became a movement over the last 8 years. Chambers joined me last month to share more about her book and begins with how the three women who started Black Lives Matter came together.
It was really interesting to go back and look at a movement that's so new. I mean, in 2013, Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Cullors came together really over the death of Trayvon Martin and how that case played out. And Alicia famously wrote a Facebook post in which she said, you know, I love you, our lives matter, Black lives matter. And what was interesting in the book, I sort of take a step back and look at their early lives because the book is for younger readers and parents and teachers, librarians. And it was just interesting to see how, you know, these three really disparate girls growing up in different parts of the country kind of come together from like student activism to grown-up activism, and what started as a hashtag became a movement.
And Opal Tometi told The Guardian in 2020 that, quote, from the beginning when I built blacklivesmatter.com, I went to the website and wrote, Black queer lives matter, Black immigrants matter, Black disabled folks matter. You know, this movement is about all of us and recognizing that Black people aren't a monolith. And your book also points that not all protest is a monolith. There's no one way to protest, and it comes in many forms. So why did you feel this was important to share for young readers?
Yeah, I think that it was... Last year was so incredible, right? Like last summer, between 15 and 26 million people protested in some sort of Black Lives Matter protest. I think that that number, experts believe, make it one of the largest protests in our nation's history. So for me, looking at this book and this protest as a journalist, it was one saying, how did so many people come to this moment where they literally took to the streets around this issue, and a really diverse group. Like last year was the most diverse group. It wasn't just Black people protesting, and you had so many different groups, doctors for Black Lives Matter, EMT for Black Lives Matter, even some police officers who supported them as well, and say, okay, how did that happen? But then I think the bigger question was, why do people protest and why does it matter? And, you know, one of the things that I found out in researching the book is that between 1900 and 2016, over 50% of peaceful protests have had significant change in government. It has become the mode of change as opposed to more violent and, you know, kind of like the old idea of a violent revolution. And so I wanted to contextualize for people that this is really like a part of a long history in America of peaceful protests coming together to make meaningful change.
Well, and also that protesters and activists, they come in many shapes, forms, and ages too, that, you know, it really drives the point home that you're not too young to start your activist journey.
Yeah, we actually end the book by talking about young protesters in all kinds of backgrounds. So Mary Kopeny, who Little Miss Flint, who wrote letters to President Obama and really was able to do significant work starting at the age of 9 to better the water quality in Flint, Michigan. We talk about the kids in March for Our Lives and of course, Greta Thunberg and the climate change activists. And so we really wanted kids to get an idea of what protest is, why it matters, and how you can use your voice for whatever cause you believe in.
Well, and that breakdown you just mentioned is kind of shaped in the structure of this book as well, and that it's meant for young readers. Obviously, adults can certainly get a lot out of what's in here. But with the goal of reaching out to young readers specifically, how did that shape the structure of what you wanted to include? You know, for example, there's a whole section on what is systemic racism. There's even protest playlists and things like that. So how did that help shape your goal and the whole structure?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I always say that the first draft of this book, it was like me trying to imitate Isabel Wilkerson's Cast, which I think was probably the most important book that I read last year. And then I realized, oh, you can't write a younger version of Cast because that's her book. And so, you know, anyone who's ever tried to write a book has a book they admire so much and they end up like kind of like wanting your book to be like that. And you have to figure out your own thing. So, you know, every book is architectural, right? Like you have to decide how many chapters, what are they about? And so what I decided was that I would spend the first half of the book talking about the Black Lives Matter movement and how we as a nation got to the moment of 2020. So I do talk about systemic racism. I talk about the Black codes and the economic elements of Black life in America and how that sort of has tied together to some of these things. Like, for example, something that I think people don't always know is that, like, for example, in Reconstruction, there was a thing, part of the reason the chain gang started is that it was really hard to work farms without low-paying labor. And after enslaved people were set free, the only way that you could get someone to work for you for free was if they had been arrested and indicted. So you started to get this thing of Black men in particular, as you know, early as the late 1800s, getting arrested and then thrown back into what effectively was slavery. Like, I thought that was something that was important. It's not something I learned when I was in elementary school or middle school. So I thought, you know, without saying this is a blame thing or some people are racist or whatever, what I really wanted to convey and what I think Black Lives Matter and these activists and leaders have done is that it's not about a racist person, a racist town, a racist state, even one racist act. It's really about how race is enmeshed in our lives in ways that our generation don't even realize how far it goes back. And so I spent the first half of the book talking about that. And then the second half of the book, I made a decision to really like almost like turn the camera on how people protest. So there's a chapter on sports and I talk about everything from like Naomi Osaka and her mask to Colin Kaepernick and Maya Moore, the basketball player. And then there's a chapter on music. I mean, I wish I could have written 50 pages on music. You know, there was a great organization called Bakers Against Racism, and you can find them on Instagram. And this amazing young woman, Paola Velez, and along with a number of other professional pastry chefs, started this nationwide bake sale, and within a summer had raised $2 million for racial justice organizations. And these were people who had been furloughed during the pandemic. So one of the things she said is, I started with $0 and I've raised millions. It's now over $2.5 million that they've raised baking pies and pound cakes and cookies. And so I just thought that was a great message to send to kids and families and communities that whatever cause you believe in, there is a way for you to make some change. And when a lot of people get together and do something like a bake sale against racism, you can actually make a lot of change.
One of the ways you highlight in that citizens are making change is through citizen journalism. And as a journalist, kind of reflecting on how this has played a massive role in the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, from tweeting as you go to a protest, or especially in Ferguson, like the events that unfolded there and the role that social media played in that. How did that strike you, including the real-time citizen reporting compared to the more historical looks at how citizens participated in other moments, such as like the civil rights and protest history when there wasn't Facebook or Twitter or anything like that to contribute to the moment?
Yeah, I think a lot of times we know the bad side of social media. What we know at this point is that social media has become an incredibly powerful tool for people to not only get out a message about some sort of organizing, but also to cast light on things that are happening. So, you know, we talked to Janetta Elzey and DeRay McKesson, for example, who were both very much citizen journalists. They were using Twitter and other forms of social media to say, this is what's happening right now. This is where we need help. This is what we want you to see. You know, the catchphrase of the Washington Post is that democracy dies in the darkness. And I think the important thing about the citizen journalists is that they really are saying, it's not just that things are happening, but if no one sees it, it's as if it didn't happen. And so that accountability is incredibly important in any element, be it Black Lives Matter, climate change, women's rights, immigrant rights, gay rights, trans rights. Like, we need the light shined upon it, to quote Ida B. Wells.
There are also many photos documenting the history of not just the Black Lives Matter marches of the last 8 years, but also the civil rights movement during the 1960s. So what did you find yourself reflecting on when you were compiling these images that stood decades apart, yet had similar scenes, goals, and emotions?
Yeah, there are over 100 photographs in the book, and I like photographs for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that you look at a great photo. You know, I have open page 10 of the book, May 31st in New York, and there's thousands and thousands of people descending on the Brooklyn Bridge, which is pretty close to where I grew up. And you look at that photo and it tells its own story. You don't need me to say Black Lives Matter, or this is an important movement. What this photo says is, look at all these people who showed up. I also, you know, on the opposite page, love a picture of this beautiful 8-year-old girl, Kay Marie Dixon, in California. And she's got a pink cowboy hat and a pink shirt and her brown cowboy boots. And she's on a horse, and she's part of a peaceful protest that was organized by the Compton Cowboys. And they rode horses through the streets of Los Angeles as their protest. And so I think, you know, there've been paddle outs by surfers all over the country. My daughter skateboards, so I kind of love the skateboard protests. And they also were many, many cyclist protests, where you see everything from kids on tricycles to like really like professional racers on those super sleek bikes. And when you just, I think that what the photographs give is a sense of community. And you see people getting together in community, lots of different kinds of people showing up because they believe in something.
What were some of the challenges you worked through in writing a book that required researching history as it was happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think that on one hand, it might have been easier if we had, you know, years to write it, but we also wanted to capture some of the energy of last summer and the magnitude of it. So what we really decided to do was ground it in the photographs. And then I think, you know, I definitely had a version where the historical part, the civil rights movement, all of that was just because everything that happened last summer had a history. But kind of telling myself, okay, most kids will learn about Martin Luther King Jr. in school, so I don't have to get too far into that. But we did make two timelines, a modern civil rights movement timeline and a Black Lives Matter timeline, so that people could see how both movements had developed. And then, you know, you mentioned the playlist and then the music section, because music has been such an important part of protests, you know, because we felt like music is part of it too. So
did this impact like a sense of urgency to get this book out? capturing, like you said, that moment and the momentum?
I think so. I think we wanted, you know, I mean, if you look at the news cycle, every day there's something new, but we wanted to, thinking about kids coming back to school in the fall and families getting together, we wanted to create a document that would keep the conversations going, you know? And that's partly why we call the book Call and Response, because that of course refers to, you know, a very old storytelling tradition, but it also refers to the kind of protest call and response that you see when people say, when the marshal says, whose streets? And everyone responds, our streets. But we also thought call and response is about a conversation. And what we really hope is that the book is the start of some really great conversations for people.
Veronica Chambers is the editor of Narrative Projects at the New York Times and author of Call and Response, The Story of Black Lives Matter. We spoke last month.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Angelina Mosier Salazar. Historical sites, Milwaukee is filled with them. Like the opulent Victorian mansion of Frederick Pabst, the president of, yes, you guessed it, Pabst Brewery. Or even the Wisconsin Historical Society's building on Old World 3rd Street in Kilbourne. Originally built as a bank more than 100 years ago, it is outfitted with a mezzanine, atrium, and Scagolia columns, which apparently make marble columns look pedestrian. But Bubbler Talk listener Eloisa wanted to know,
what and where are the historic landmarks that people can go to get a better sense of the local Latino history?
With the first Latinos arriving more than 100 years ago and the community making up almost 20% of city residents, I thought, great, I'll just look on TripAdvisor for the answer. Well, turns out there isn't one. Okay, well, I'd give a walking tour of Hispanic historical sites a try. There isn't one of those either. So I turned to the Wisconsin Historical Society database and started searching and searching and searching. And nothing. I thought I was missing something, but it turns out I wasn't.
There are no official sites listed on either the National Register or in the State Register. That doesn't mean, of course, that those sites don't exist. It just means that they haven't been recognized by those official channels.
That's Sergio Gonzalez, professor of history and Latinx studies at Marquette University. And he says Latinos aren't largely considered part of Wisconsin's history.
The way in which we recognize specific places as being historically relevant in many ways dictates what we think is important about who we are as a people. And the fact that Latinos don't have any recognized place on the National Register speaks to that larger forgetting of a century-long history of our people in the state.
I reported back to Eloisa, our Bubbler Talk listener.
The answer to your question is that there are no official historic sites in Milwaukee that commemorate or honor the Latino community.
That's horrible. That really is. That's so sad.
It is awful. As a reporter who covers issues in the Latino community, I have to admit I was surprised to learn that there are no historical landmarks to reflect the history and impact of Milwaukee's Latino community. Professor Gonzalez says there are reasons for that. One is the convoluted process of actually making something a historic landmark. Another barrier is that in order to get a place designated as historic, the nominations have to come organically from the community. Jeremy Ebersole is executive director of the Milwaukee Preservation Alliance, which works to help people navigate the complicated process of historic preservation.
Preservation is not about preserving only certain types of significances, only certain populations, stories. Anyone in this city can and should be willing to submit a nomination for a building if that place is important to your community.
Listener Eloisa is a history buff at heart. But for her, as a Mexican Milwaukeean whose family was part of many early community gatherings, the question is personal.
We all do want those roots. And so if we don't do things like that, we lose something of personal value to us individually, as a family, and as a larger community.
To find out what is being done locally to preserve Latino heritage sites and how you can nominate a place for historic designation, go to our site, wuwm.com. Angelina Mosier Salazar, 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one more break and then learn how Milwaukee and Memphis collide in Zach Pietrini and McKenna Bray's new EP, Modern Love. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before the pandemic began, Lake Effect featured a variety of in-studio performances from local musicians and artists. And although some theaters and venues are starting to welcome back live performances with some limitations and requirements, we'll still be featuring artists in a series we call Pandemic Performers. Milwaukee singer-songwriter Zach Pietrini and Memphis singer-songwriter McKenna Bray initially teamed up in March of 2020 for their EP called Modern Love. But when lockdown hit and their tour was canceled, they continued their partnership and began writing new music. The result is their new EP, Modern Love, and that was fully released this month. I spoke to Pietrini and Bray in May ahead of the release as a part of our Pandemic Performers series. We'll start by listening to some of their first release single, Young Love.
Just 16, not afraid to die, staring at love until we went blind, stealing cigarettes, running through the night, like spirits let loose out of heaven's light. So keep the motor running, hear the engine hum. Hearts beating blood. Young love, young love, young love, young love.
So that was Young Love from your new EP, Modern Love. And to start, how did this musical partnership come about? McKenna, you're based in Memphis, and Zach, you're here in Milwaukee. So what brought you two together?
Yeah. Well, I was in Memphis and I was looking for just some touring advice, and because I had toured before, but nothing as crazy as Zach had done. And so my friend Darren in Memphis actually connected me to Zach. And so he gave me his phone number and he's like, you should reach out to him, just pick his brain. And I was like, okay. So we set up a phone call with each other, and at first it was just trying to get advice, and we were just telling each other our stories and his musical journey and mine, and one thing led to another, and he was just like, well, heck, let's just tour together. And I was like, okay, sure, I'm in.
Yeah, I'll confirm that story. Yeah. So that was it. Like, it was a mutual friend, and like from the phone conversation, we kind of both, I just like professionally hit it off, where it was like, We both are kind of go-getters. We're both people who respond, I think, pretty well to, yeah, just like digging in and working hard. And I found that over the last few years, the more successful tours are pretty much always when I like partner up with other people. You're pulling from two places, which is huge, because I mean, in the past, it's like, oh my gosh, you have to work so hard to build an audience in these other cities. What if we just trade cities and everybody wins? So. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And of course, this series is called Pandemic Performers, and you did not go on this tour that you had planned. So how did it go from planning a tour, you know, with your both own musical things separately together, and then developing this EP, Modern Love?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it was kind of a unique situation, I feel like, where we had spent so much time together on the phone, basically, for like 6 months in planning this tour. So in a lot of ways, we really got to know each other. And I think just kind of develop an appreciation for one another and friendship in that space. And so I came down to Memphis, you know, obviously with the intention, that's where we started. We played a couple shows, everything shut down, but McKenna had booked us a day in the studio in Nashville that she does, she recorded a bunch there.
Yeah, I record there often, so.
Yeah, so it was Farmland Studios with the engineer producer, Caleb Fisher, who worked on this with us. Anyway, so we had a day off, we were there, we were seeing everything shut down. We're like, oh my gosh, like, hopefully we can get something redemptive out of this this process. And yeah. So we were just in the studio that one day and basically finished about 97% of the first song, which was Keep On Running. And I think we were all just kind of taken back by how easy the process was, but also how much we liked the song. And so very shortly thereafter, like I had to go home, she had to go home, but we really enjoyed the process so much that we just kept writing. And I think that was kind of the...
keeping us sane
in yeah.
the midst of all of it, so.
Totally.
And what qualities in each other do you find the most valuable in a musical partner that helped shape this project?
For sure, our different strengths. Like Zach is so strong in lyric and can write poetry every single day and write a song, like it's so easy for him. But melody is my strength. Not that you're not good at it, you are, but I'm more strong in like melody than I am lyrically. And so he would come to me sometimes with a lyric without melody. And then I would be like, what if we sang it this way? Or I would come to him with a melody and then he would fill in all those gaps with beautiful words. So it was just like, honestly, I felt like we clicked so well
yeah.
with our strengths and our weaknesses. We're able to make each other better by working with each other for so long.
I would agree with that. yeah, that's a big part. And again, like I think there's no shortage of people who kind of want to like, I mean, you want to play music, you want to just play music on the weekend, like that's the beautiful thing about music. Anybody can interact with it the way that they want. I think some of the difficult part is to find a team of people or a group or even just like a duo where you both value it the same way. You're both committed to this idea of like working really hard, of pushing, of sending the emails, making the phone calls, making sure things are successful. And like, that was something that I found about McKenna like right away, you know, is that it's like, I found somebody who it's like, yeah, we're going to figure it out. We're going to push hard. We're going to make this work. So in addition to what she said, that was, I think, a big part of it too.
Well, on the note of pushing hard and driving forward, let's hear a little bit of Ends in Fire. This is a really good, strong track.
Sinking, it's all wrong to burn all that we believed in. There's a lie you're leaving, pious songs to make a spark. It takes two. You struck the match, maybe I can too. Oh, this all ends in fire. You're the ash and I'm the climbing higher. You're the cigarettes, and baby, I'm the lighter. Oh, this just ends in fire.
So McKenna, can you talk a little bit about Ends in Fire? Because, like, wow, does it show off your voice range in the best way. So did you have fun with this rock and roll sound?
Oh my gosh, it was so fun. I feel like I have wanted to do a song like this for so long, but it's like, it's hard to create something like this on your own. And like, I think when you, me and Caleb were in the studio, they were just shredding the electric guitar. And I was like, this is so fun. I've always wanted to do this. Like I let loose and it was just like, we had no rules. We had no idea of like what wanted to sound like. We just went in and just went crazy with it. And like vocally, it was definitely a stretch, but yeah. I think that's, they just created this vibe that it needed something like that vocally. So it was really fun to sing it and also tiring at the same time.
Yeah, when we finished writing that tune, I remember I was up in my bedroom while we were working on it, and we finished it, and it was pretty clear to both of us. We were like, so McKenna, you're singing the song, right? And she's like, yeah, yes, yeah.
Did the song also impact the art of the album, which is this great classic old school tattoo designs that has elements of this song kind of all throughout it?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we wanted to put in elements of every song that way. And we had talked a bit about it. And that was one of the things. So McKenna and I are really good, like opposite sides to the same coin type of people. And so like, we were like, how can we make something that kind of represents like you're more, I don't know, like I would say maybe I am the darker, maybe a little grittier.
More like grungy.
Yeah. And then you're more of like the, you know,
a dainty flower.
Yeah. You're like Elsa or Anna. I don't know.
Who Anna, you've been that. Anna is my.
And I'm Kristoff, right? Maybe in that scenario. But anyway, so yeah. So like, how can we like represent that push and pull? And yeah, the traditional.
Tattoo. He thought of the traditional American tattoo art, and I think it just creates that perfect vibe for our songs visually.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the story arc of this EP, you know, as a listener, we're kind of following the ebbs and flows, the highs and lows of this story of a modern love, of relationships, and really quite effectively in a 5-song arc. That's the final product of this EP. So what came first, the theme or the few songs you had developed?
Few songs, I think. So we started with Keep On Running. And then after that, Zach had shown me Young Love. And then he also showed me Amelia. And then we wrote Ends in Fire, then Yours. And so it's kind of, we had one and then we had another love song. And then Zach was like, heck, let's make this like a love song EP, because that's like what we were writing. I don't know why, it was just natural. And so we ended up just kind of creating this EP that I think talks about just the complexities of love, the, like you said, the highs, the lows, and just a fun, intense, and like soft way. It captures all of it.
Well, and I love how it seems like this was just a very organic thing that happened out of a really hard pivot, you know, for a lot of musicians, right? And this great project came out of it and this great partnership. So how did this EP fulfill or impact the both of you after you had to go through such changes as musicians during a pandemic?
Yeah, geez. I mean, a conversation that I had with like a mentor and a friend in this time, a lot of it was like, you have to like have something to make you move forward or just up. Like you have to do something, because right now you are feeling stuck, like you are feeling trapped. And to know that, like, we have a standing once a week phone call where we're on FaceTime or whatever, and we're writing, or we're dealing with business, or we're dealing with booking, like it's always something like that. And so I think just having something that kept things moving and not feeling like, well, great, I just missed out on a whole year of my career, you know, like, mm-hmm. It definitely shifts the timbre of the conversation to like, no, I get to have a year to just write. Mm-hmm. And I get to have a year to develop this relationship. And I get to like, and so it creates a more gracious posture, and which I think is way better for art, you know, as opposed to just like an entitled angry one.
That was so well said. And just to tag on to that, like, I think as an artist, especially starting out or just early in your career, you're juggling everything. Like you're juggling the songwriting, the booking, the emails, the everything. And so I feel like with the pandemic, as awful as it was or still is, it kind of forced us this space of creativity. So it's like, well, you can either complain about it or you can do something about it. And so like we literally weren't able to book. Like we were not to do any of that because no one was booking. So like we only were able to create. Mm-hmm. So it was just so much freedom without the pressures of the world telling you, you needed to be here at this time or whatever. It was just like, you can only create right now. And I think it was a blessing for totally. This EP.
And even in that space too, it's just like, we didn't, it's not like it has to work out. So like if at the end of a writing session, the song sucked, great, we're not going to use it. Yeah. You know, like it wasn't like, oh crap, like I hope this session works out. It was just like, whatever comes. And if it doesn't, that's okay. We'll do it again next week.
Well, what came of this is a really fantastic EP. And before we end with the last song, Keep On Running, I just want to thank you, Zach and McKenna, for joining me to talk about Modern Love.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate you having us on. Yeah.
Singer-songwriter Zach Pietrini and McKenna Bray's EP is called Modern Love. The full EP is out now, and the duo will finally set out on their rescheduled tour throughout the Midwest and South in October. We spoke back in May. Their song Keep On Running wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on Like Effect, we'll speak with a former politician who helped Cuban refugees living at Fort McCoy transition to life here in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll speak with a Milwaukee Public Museum researcher about the discovery of a new species of boa found in the Dominican Republic. That's tomorrow at noon on Like Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We used to lie intertwined. I felt the beat of your heart and mine. No, I could play somewhere out of time. We don't do